welcome everyone to WIHI, an audio discussion with EDGE, as in cutting edge, from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Often to bend the envelope and to move into new innovative space, we have to first figure out the current state, and that seems to apply to our topic today, improving care for patients with advanced illness. There's been a tremendous amount of work in this area for decades now, but it's not always clear how to size it up, where and what are the models to emulate, and where do we need to focus our attention next? What are patients asking for? What resources are needed to do a better job at responding to patients and families when a life may be ending? That's what Diane Meyer and Jim Conway are going to help us sort out on today's WIHI. My name is Madge Kaplan, and my guests today to help us think through quality care during advanced illness are first Dr. Diane Meyer. She's director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care, a national organization devoted to increasing the number and quality of palliative care programs in the United States. Under her leadership, the number of such programs has more than doubled in the U.S. in the last 5 years. Dr. Meyer is also director of the Lillian and Benjamin Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute, professor of geriatrics and internal medicine, and Catherine Gaisman, professor of medical ethics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. She is the principal investigator of an NCI-funded five-year multi-site study on the outcomes of hospital palliative care services in cancer patients. We can perhaps find out a little bit more about that today. Welcome, Diane Meyer.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Stand by while I introduce the great Jim Conway. He is a senior vice president at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He came to IHI after serving for 10 years as executive vice president and COO of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Prior to joining Dana-Farber, Jim had a 27-year career at Children's Hospital in Boston in radiology administration, finance, and as assistant hospital director for patient care services. His areas of expertise are many. They include governance and executive leadership, patient safety, change management, and patient and family-centered care. Jim is a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee on Identifying and Preventing Medication Errors, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Quality and Cost Council, that's very relevant to our discussion today, the Clinical Issues Advisory Council of the Massachusetts Hospital Association, and a past member of the Joint Commission Sentinel Advisory Committee. And I'm going to let Jim explain in just a few minutes why he's really thinking a lot about improving care for people with advanced illness here in Massachusetts lately. I think that's been a lifelong journey for him, but something he's thinking about anew. So let's get started. One truism about the topic of advanced illness, or maybe I should say advancing age and the increasing possibility of serious illness and the definite eventuality of death, although I know many of us are looking for an alternative, is that it's certainly relevant to all of us. Yet it seems to be a noticeable priority for some, but not always many. And in improvement and in reform worlds, it seems that building these systems and infrastructure and focus tends to come and go. So Dr. Diane Meyer, joining us by phone. Diane, what state are you in today, I should ask?
I'm in Chicago.
You're in Chicago. Well, welcome from Chicago. So my assessment there, that the focus tends to come and go and we're not always sure if this is a priority or not, is that a fair assessment or it just depends on where you're looking and maybe I just haven't been paying attention?
Well, I certainly think the public attention to this issue waxes and wanes with whether prominent politicians or stars are facing serious illness or death, whether there are high media targets like Terry Schiavo going on or death panel discussions going on. But the fact remains that, as you pointed out earlier, serious illness and eventually death is a universal one for every customer. So everyone has a stake in this issue, and everyone is concerned about it, whether in an immediate way or a hypothetical distant way. It's on everybody's level of concern at some point. And so it's what the media tend to call an evergreen issue.
An evergreen issue, which, right. Yeah, I mean, has its pluses and minuses. It's kind of either. I see Jim nodding, and, you know, I sort of have a logic here, but I just want to bring Jim Conway in right away. What do you think about that, Jim, in terms of the focus and the fact that it comes and goes? or seems to.
Well, Madge, first of all, it's great to be here with you, Diane, and the whole community today. What I'm struck with, whether it's in our work in IHI across the country or specifically in Massachusetts, and I'll set that up a little bit more later, is that we're clearly hearing increased dissatisfaction from patients, family members, and healthcare staff who are coming to work every day to care for them, they're unhappy with the experience of care of those with patients with advanced illness, and specifically the care at the time of death. And I do think that this right now is being fueled by a very growing consumerism and the desire that it's time to build a healthcare system that finally revolves around the patient and not everybody else.
Okay. Well said, Jim. Diane, at 30,000 feet, kind of maybe teeing off Jim here, what would you say is the problem or the problems that we're trying to solve? Or should we not be thinking about this in terms of problems we're trying to solve or some other way?
Well, I certainly think there are many problems that we need to solve, and among them are a very high level of physical pain and other symptoms among patients with serious illness in America's best hospitals, and there have been a number of studies repeatedly demonstrating that we've got a problem here, Houston. We think we're doing a good job, but our patients are suffering terribly. We also have good data on the enormous fragmentation in the healthcare system, the number of different subspecialists that seriously ill patients have to see in their last 6 to 12 months of life just in order to try to get medical care out of what I would call a healthcare marketplace as opposed to a healthcare system. And the number one concern, interestingly, in lots of studies of patients and their loved ones who are dealing with the healthcare system during advanced illness is, and this is hard to believe for some of us doctors, not enough time with doctors. Not enough time with their doctors. And if you walk through my hospital or any hospital, the place is crawling with doctors. There's nothing but doctors everywhere you look. And most patients have multiple doctors whose names are on their charts, who are billing for their care, and yet the perception of the objects of all this effort, that is the patient and the patient's family, is that they can't get any traction with the doctor. They can't get time with the doctor. Well, why is that? I mean, the reason for that is that all of the incentives for physicians and other providers are basically to run more widgets through the system, to see as many people as possible in as short a period of time as possible, and to do as many remunerative procedures as possible, because those are the financial incentives, that is the business case that keeps our hospital's doors open. And as long as those financial incentives remain in place, we're not going to be able to restore attention and focus to where it belongs, which is on the patient and the family and what they need.
So doctors are one of the interesting things about all these issues is sort of what the different realities are depending on where you stand and the experience. And I was struck when you just said that sometimes doctors are surprised to hear that patients don't feel that they have enough time. And can you just say a little bit more about that? Just because a place is crawling with physicians doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that a patient feels they've had any focused engagement with any one physician.
Right. I mean, from the physician standpoint, the way I experience this, and I assume the way my colleagues do, is that we walk into the hospital in the morning, early in the morning. We have a long list of both patients we need to see and things we need to get done. New demands, new patients needing to be seen come in all through the day, and the sense of time pressure is overwhelming, of needing to get more and more done in the same narrow frame of 24 hours in the day. Without let up. And the metrics that we are held to really are about how many patients we see, how many remunerative procedures we do, how much money we bring in, really. The metric is not about did we spend enough time with this patient and family so that they felt that all their questions were answered and they understood their alternatives and the pros and cons of the different alternatives and felt they were making a fully informed and supported decision. That's not measured. That's not a metric under which doctors' performance is rated. Mm-hmm. And so I think many of us feel increasingly dissatisfied with our work life because of the enormous volume and time pressures And increasingly, like, this is not why we went to medical school. And yet, the explicit rewards and punishments that doctors and other health professionals face are really about maximizing income and maximizing throughput. Mm-hmm. And that works very much against quality of care for the individual patient.
You're putting a lot of emphasis on finances, incentives, sort of system-level things, which, of course, makes a lot of sense. I'm going to ask Jim to jump into this as well. From the patient perspective, and maybe, I don't know if this is kind of just the, if this is a mythology or what, there's often a sense that doctors don't want to deal with death, that they don't want to deal with the patient's death because it's all about cure, frankly. And that's mm-hmm. when most physicians then sort of take a right turn down the hallway. What I'm hearing from you is that perhaps, if that has been true, that's indeed perhaps been changing.
Well, I think that is another variable. That is, many physicians have never been taught how to have a conversation about goals of care and what the alternatives are for patients and families. They've never seen it done. They've never received a lecture on how to break bad news or have a goals conversation. And like other people, doctors like to do what they're good at and what they've been really well-trained in doing. And if we're expected to do something we've never seen in medical school or residency, we've never seen a supervisor do, we certainly can't get paid for doing. And there are enormous time and financial pressures on us not to spend 45 minutes or 60 minutes having a lengthy and difficult conversation with a patient and family. Mm-hmm. You can see why most of us don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the forces are arrayed against helping physicians remain present and loyal to their patients in a way, no matter what happens, even when the worst happens and we can no longer effectively prolong life.
Yep.
The forces are so strong against staying with our patients that it's a miracle that any doctors are able to do it at all.
So I promise everybody who's joined us today, and I want to welcome you again. This is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan. You were just listening to Dr. Diane Meyer, and Jim Conway is here with me in the studio, and we are talking about the goals and what it is we're trying to achieve with patients with advanced illness. I think we're going to start hearing about also some positive things that are working well. I want to ask Jim Conway, though, which maybe this is too obvious a question, given anything that Diane and you both have already laid out, but is this a case of the healthcare system really lagging behind what the public really wants? Because I think we hear, you know, many of us now can go into a bookstore and get some of the most innovative kind of treatises right now on what it means to really have your wishes respected, et cetera, and kind of what quality means at this time. So what's going on with the healthcare system?
Well, you know, I have two immediate reactions to that question. First is, in my 40 years in healthcare, I've been struck that most people come today, work every day in service of the patient. They want to do the right thing. And in my experience at Dana-Farber's, doctors told me that they're in the business of the cure. They're not in the business of death. And if there is another opportunity, another generation, another test that they felt could help the patient, then they felt a responsibility to offer that. I think what's striking now is as we engage with consumers, we're hearing different things, and the evidence is emerging. So, you know, a couple of thoughts of that is the first that, you know, I've learned in our patient and family-centered care work that if you want to know what a patient thinks, you ask them the question, then you shut up and you listen. And what they're telling us,
no.
And when the first thing that I've been struck with is you don't have to go far to hear a story of a bad death. It is almost quickly you hear the story. The second is, people want to talk about this. I'm really struck. I was giving a talk to a group of seniors, about 150 seniors at the Brookline Senior Center. The average age was probably 75. And one of the women asked the question. She said, "Honey, a hearse comes to my place every week. why doesn't anybody talk to me about this stuff? We're finding it. You and I did a session, Madge, with Cambridge Adult Education. It came up there. I did a session with our local Rotary. It came up there. People wanted to talk about it. And I think the other thing, through colleagues like work that Diane has done, the amazing study that Alexi Wright and the team led out of Dana-Farber, the five-city study that when probing the question, do cancer patients want to talk about care at the end of life, the answer is 80% do. Are there a group that don't? Absolutely. So we have a mental model that's flawed, and what we're learning is from the consumers and from others that we have to challenge this mental model.
Okay. All right. We're about 20 minutes underway. About 300 of you have joined today. More continue to log on. This is WIHI, and I'm Madge Kaplan. That was Jim Conway. Diane Meyer is with us on the phone. I'm going to have Jim in just a minute talk a little bit about what's going on here in Massachusetts and why this has become an interesting focus and perhaps, again, a model for others. But Jim and Diane both, I want to say that as I thought about these various landscape of this, the need for some kind of advanced discussion, the illness itself and treatment issues and palliative options and pain options, and then where you want to be. If indeed this is the end of your life, where do you want to die? And one thing that occurred to me as I was going through a lot of literature and discussion thus far, a lot of confusion. I mean, you, Diane, talked about all the pressures in our current healthcare system and where to kind of wedge this in to the current system. But it also feels very unclear sometimes whose responsibility are all these different parts. And maybe it clearly goes beyond the healthcare system. I know that's kind of a whopping question, but could you take a stab at that, Diane? Whose responsibility, or does it everybody's responsibility become no one's responsibility?
Well, certainly good medical care is shared decision-making and shared responsibility. I think no one would argue with that. When people have talked about advanced care planning, that's things like saying who you would trust to make medical decisions on your behalf if you are unable to make your own decisions. That is a conversation that every adult should have with their primary care provider. For example, my children, who are now 20 and 23, have appointed medical decision makers in case they lose capacity to make their own decisions, because I've worked long enough in the system with patients who haven't done this to know how problematic it is when someone has not appointed a decision maker. But that's really part of primary care, just like getting counseling about seatbelts or vaccines. The advanced care planning process is a routine part of primary care. When, however, someone is diagnosed with a serious and usually chronic illness, what we hope happens, but which rarely does in our system, is that they retain their primary care relationship, their main doctor, whether it's an internist or a family medicine person or a geriatrician, and then they also work with a specialist who has expertise in their particular illness or illnesses such as cancer or heart failure, and that the process of managing the disease is the disease plural themselves is a shared responsibility between the primary care physician and the specialist. And I think that's a vision that's not something that is in actuality the case for most patients today, because most patients lose their primary care relationship when they are diagnosed with a serious or advanced illness such as cancer and end up seeing only their oncologist. And that's a real loss, because there are many functions that the primary provider delivers to the patient that the specialist simply cannot provide. And one of those things is, for example, the management of symptoms, pain, shortness of breath, nausea, fatigue, depression, anxiety. Every physician should have a basic platform of training in those areas. Most of us, however, didn't receive any. It's always shocking when I talk to public audiences, it's shocking to those audiences to hear how little and often no training their doctors have had in simple things like the management of pain. Because pain is one of the most frightening aspects of serious illness for patients. It's the things people say first when asked what their biggest concern is. about our healthcare system is that their pain and other symptoms will not be adequately addressed.
Yeah.
And those fears, unfortunately, are justified because their doctors have not been trained.
Right.
So those are the things that need to be fixed. Why we need palliative care here is because most doctors have not been trained to do this. We need palliative care experts both to do the teaching of the next generation.
Right.
And to help existing professionals when their patients get very complex and their needs exceed their skills and training.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to maybe start to find it. You've obviously been able to make some inroads with new programs. There are some things that are changing in training. So, Jim, talk to us a little bit about Massachusetts. This is something I've been aware that you've been engaged in for at least the last year or so.
Right.
So what's going on?
Sure. Thanks, Madge. Well, as people on the call may have heard on prior calls, IHI is intimately involved in health reform in Massachusetts. And as you may know, when health reform was passed in April of 2006, it was passed with the goal of improving quality and safety, reducing cost, and improving coverage, and was so proud that 98% of the residents of Massachusetts have coverage, but we still have to advance the quality and safety agenda. When we went into the field to probe what our priorities should be in Massachusetts, one of the immediate comments we were hearing is that we were not honoring patients' wishes at the end of life in Massachusetts. All the data from all the studies say that patients want to die at home, yet in Massachusetts, it's about 20% of patients die at home. Also, we all understand the role of hospice care, yet in Massachusetts, we found that only 40% of patients dying were under hospice care at the end of life. So the Quality and Cost Council of Health Reform became very interested in this, and the legislature and governor picked up the message, and they passed legislation that required us to activate a campaign in the Commonwealth to promote awareness around advanced care planning. The second thing is they stimulated us to do a pilot of an initiative which we've learning from another states around the country called POLST, Physician's Order of Life-Sustaining Treatment. So you have a very durable order that travels with the patient over care. The third is they charged an expert panel to meet to deal over the summer with respectful care at the end of life. And the fourth is they asked us to come up with measures of public reporting, because we in fact believe in the state as well as in IHI that there's no safety and quality without transparency. So let me just touch on the work of the expert panel, because I was struck how it really was touching on a lot of what Diane was talking about. The first, this is an amazing group of broad-based stakeholders. This is consumers. This is people representing religion. This is healthcare leaders. This is members of the legislature. There's over 40 people who are participating in this process. What we've chosen to do is to key off of the National Quality Forum, National Priorities Partnership work in this space. We are not, no need to reinvent the wheel. We thought that the work that was done by this group was extraordinarily well done. Playing off of their work, we focused on three groups, one looking at access, one looking at communications, and another group looking at workforce. And what we have been struck with is the exciting learning and generosity that we've got from everybody. There has been amazing work done in this space. Diane's organization, CAPSI, Joanne Lynn's work, Aetna, the VA, the Health Research Education Trust, ICSI, many groups have done great work. And then what the final point before I give you a teaser of what our recommendations are going to be, which in fact won't be surprising, but there's wonderful clarity around them, is everything that we're doing is in the public domain. So in the resources that you get after this call, you will see a hyperlink that brings you into all of the content that the expert panel is using to drive this work. So Madge kept saying to me, Jim, what are the recommendations? What are the recommendations?
Hot off the press.
So
almost. They're not quite baked yet.
Well, actually, Diane set them all up.
Okay.
The first, there has to be growing awareness. There has to be growing awareness both within the healthcare industry and in the community. The second is we have to put in place a system that allows this to happen reliably 100% of the time. One, right now, we're expecting doctors and nurses to remember everything and do this at this point, as opposed to doing what we've learned in safety is how do we hardwire a system with triggers, something that any of you who work with IHI know, that set up the potential for certain things to happen every single time. The third is as Diane spoke to beautifully, the payment system has to support this. And then the fourth is the workforce. We have to have sufficient numbers of people in this space, and they have to be trained appropriate for their specific role. As a baseline, everybody in healthcare should have a core curriculum in this space, like Epic or others, and then there'll be further advanced training based on that. So more to follow. Stay tuned to the expert panel website, but that's basically where we are in the Commonwealth at this point.
All right. Thanks, Jim. And all that Jim is referencing there is in a wonderful document of resources that Vicki Minden from IHI here has put together. When we put the audio archive of today's program on the website, that resource document is there. So I don't want people to stress about in chat. You can also, there clearly will be references to things in chat as well, and you can download that at the end of the program. Diane and Jim both, we opened up the chat, and here came the floodgates. I want to just really interesting comments and questions, which I'm starting to sort of group together. I want to, though, draw attention just very quickly. Somebody said that the attendance on this particular WIHI, it's about 300, and they're saying, well, you know, that's a little lower than some other times. Does that reflect our discomfort with this subject? And I would say, there are any number of things that are going on a Thursday afternoon in October for people, but I would say, Jim and Diane, and I would all say yes, that I think that, and that relates to several questions that people have asked about culture change. WIHI is geared towards primarily people who are professionals working in the healthcare environment and related parts of the social service system. I'm sure people are very, very interested in this, and yet I'm sure a lot of folks have a hard time wrapping their minds around it. Diane, what do you think?
Oh,
I keep doing this to you. Well, we could sort of break it down. People are sort of wondering about culture changes. I mean, and I think it was embedded in Jim's recommendations. Awareness, in some sense, means awareness for everybody.
Yeah. I think one of the major problems that the end-of-life field and the hospice field has faced is that we've found ourselves in the position of marketing a good death. Mm. And no one is in the market for death. And as long as we label the services we think people need and the care that we're trying to provide as end-of-life care, we will be talking to ourselves. Because the audiences that need to change their behavior based on our message are not people who are looking for a good death. They're looking for living as well as possible for as long as possible. And this is why I feel that all of the phraseology in some of the materials that we sent out and that are being used on this call, focusing on end of life, is just worsening the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is we don't know who's at the end of life pretty much either until a few days before they die or in retrospect. We need to be providing high-quality palliative care to people with advanced chronic illness, whether they're going to live 5 years or 5 days. And the end-of-life parameter or framework actually limits access to good quality care. And we really need to get more careful about our language and how we think about this. We can only identify who's dying in retrospect, but patients and families need care in prospect. And as one of my colleagues, Judy Nelson, is fond of saying about palliative care, it's too early until it's too late.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we really ought to be delivering palliative care from the point of diagnosis of a serious or complex illness throughout the course of that illness, regardless of prognosis, regardless of how long the patient is going to live, because all patients need good pain and symptom management. All patients need high-quality patient communication about their alternatives and the pros and cons and how it matches with their wishes and their goals. And all family caregivers need support and help and community resources to fulfill their role on behalf of their loved ones. If we wait till we identify people as at the end of life, we've missed 99% of the opportunity to help people.
Okay. Well, that's a very intriguing and I think kind of a very different way kind of to shift the frame. I'm curious, those of you who've joined today, feel free to comment on Diane's thoughts about sort of our language and how that maybe shifts our perspective. What do you think, Jim?
I think one of my first observations is there's nobody who is responsible for this. Everybody is responsible for this, and that's why they're not on the call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that a hospital can do their piece, an ambulatory care center can do their piece, a nursing home can do their piece, but their piece alone right. won't pull this off. And it really is bigger than a breadbasket, with the over 40 stakeholders who have come together in Massachusetts to try to figure this out. It's huge. And it's really how do we build a system not only within our organizations but across our organizations using initiatives such as POLST, which is not only a form, but it's an amazing engagement of a community to underscore how something happens reliably 100% of the time. Now, Diane and I have had this conversation about the language we use, and part of this is back to this issue of awareness. People in our state Senate didn't know what palliative care meant. They said they knew what end-of-life care was. So I absolutely believe that what we're talking about here is patients with advanced illness, patients who are seriously ill, and it's that continuum that Diane spoke beautifully about. But part of this awareness is really helping the community be able to answer the question of and understand the potential of this community called palliative care.
All right. Interesting. There are some questions that have come in through chat asking about kind of reimbursement, good old reimbursement, and how that acts as incentives or disincentives, and talking about the fact Terry Walter says under Medicare hospice, the primary physician is the only one who can bill Part B. Other consulting physicians can still bill but must go through the hospice. And several other people spoke of that as kind of a limiting issue in terms of the cross-disciplinary, multidisciplinary thing that we're talking about. Diane, you want to address that?
Well, I think, first of all cognitive specialists, whether they are family practitioners, internists, pediatricians, geriatricians, are underpaid for their work because our current reimbursement system does not value so-called cognitive specialists, that is thinking and communicating with the patient and family. It overvalues procedural care. So, for example, my husband, who is an interventional cardiologist, an hour of his time doing angioplasty probably earns him about $3,000. An hour of my time running a very complex, difficult family meeting about goals of care for a seriously ill patient brings in maybe $60 under Medicare reimbursement. So the incentives are overwhelmingly against this kind of care. That said, just as a geriatrician or an internist or a family practitioner bills Part B, Medicare Part B, or other insurers, fee for service for the time they spend taking care of patients, palliative care providers also bill fee-for-service under Part B and other insurers.
Mm-hmm.
Palliative care is reimbursable under Medicare and other commercial insurers and Medicaid. It's just reimbursed at the ridiculously low level that other primary care and cognitive specialists are reimbursed.
Okay.
So there's a myth out there that you can't get paid for doing that, and that is not true. You can get paid for doing it. And palliative care providers, because the patients are so complex, we need to learn how to bill for time and complexity, and that requires some study and some work on the rules of documentation and Medicare payment for time as opposed to things done.
Okay.
So there are ways to bill if you're spending a lot of time with a patient.
All right.
Higher level.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for that clarification, even if payment amounts aren't what they perhaps might be. A couple of interesting questions here. And again, I've been trying to sort of go through the chat and group some things. Several people have noted that the do not resuscitate orders almost becomes a sort of interesting badge somewhere, it says because there's a do not resuscitate order, certain physicians then kind of turn the other way and sort of don't interact in terms of treatment in the way that they want, that the patients might want. And somebody said, this is Leslie, who said, I appreciate your comment. I have noticed that if a patient is older and has a DNR, many physicians just write them off. They stop treating everything. Patient comes in for hypokalemia, and because he had a DNR, the MD wasn't going to treat the low potassium. It seems to be one extreme or the other. You want to, any thoughts on that? And then I'll get Jim as well.
I think that DNR is often overinterpreted as do not treat, and this is a huge educational problem for medical students, interns, and residents. We have to forgive our trainees for doing what they see done by those senior to them in the hierarchy, and because it has not been clearly explained to them that resuscitation is only about what to do in case of cardiopulmonary arrest and not about anything else. Very often the interns and the residents are pretty much on their own in the middle of the night with these kinds of decisions, are under, as I said before, enormous time pressure to see ridiculously large numbers of patients with inadequate support and staffing. And these shortcuts occur in that environment, but clearly it needs to be corrected. Patients need to be reassured they'll get all appropriate and beneficial care, whether or not they choose to have resuscitation attempts at the time that they die.
Okay. There's also a question here about some sort of stigma associated with the actual medications that are used in palliative care. I'm not even sure I necessarily understand what that question is. Does that make some sense to you?
It unfortunately does.
Okay.
I have a patient right now who has a spinal cord injury and terrible muscle spasms that is relieved without side effects by low doses of morphine, but she'd much rather take baclofen or gabapentin because it's not morphine, even though both of them cause profound sedation. The word morphine is so stigmatized and so associated with substance abuse and behaviors that people don't want to be associated with, that they will refuse even a beneficial, more safe drug rather than have an association with it. I've actually found myself falling back on using opioids that have a different name, that don't have the same stigma, so that patients get the benefit and the relief they deserve without feeling like they've been labeled as a drug addict. So if I use oxycodone, very often people don't recognize that as a derivative of morphine. So I'll say oxycodone, that's okay. If I say morphine, absolutely not. So here's part of the lack of education, both among physicians and other healthcare providers, and also very much about the public understanding that every drug can be used for good or ill. And, you know, it's about the skill of the prescriber and whether the patient receiving it is going to benefit.
Thank you. Jim?
Yeah, I wanted to come back to the question that Diane so thoughtfully spoke to around the patient with the DNR. One of the things that I have been struck with is that's another example of us being dependent on the actions of a single clinician, as opposed to make sure that a system is in place to assure that that patient receives reliable end-of-life care. One of the things that we've been looking at as part of our work in Massachusetts is national data that came out of Diane that basically reports, I think, that overall only about 50% of the hospitals in the country have formal palliative care programs either in-house or under contract. Well, that should be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And while there's lots of definitions and way to meet the requirement, not having a hardwired system in place that is going to ensure patients are supported across the care continuum is going to allow the system of individualistic care delivery to occur over and over and over again. And one of the things that we've been very struck with in Massachusetts and will no doubt set an expectation that 100% of the hospitals in Massachusetts have to have a formal program of palliative care in-house or under contract, and they have to have also 100% of them have to have either in-house or under contract hospice programs. So we're integrating and building this system to allow palliative care to be delivered reliably 100% of the time. Sounds a lot like IHI speak, and it is.
But one thing I'm wondering about is I hear the word have to. Do you think there needs to be regulation, legislation, that really
yes.
kind of pushes this?
Yeah. I believe in Dunavedian taught us about structure, process, and outcome measures, and I think some critical structure measures are going to be hospice programs, palliative care programs, and training programs for staff.
Mm-hmm.
Those need to be in place as a structure to create the environment we want.
Donna Close, thanks, Jim. Donna Kloss, I'm sorry, or Close writes in here, I created a presentation for my CEO and key members of administrative leadership outlining the benefits of a palliative care program. It was very well received. I found more consternation with the physicians tab to provide their input. Not a surprise, however, it gave strong direction for a plan of action. So that's an interesting action step in terms of actually sort of, you know, taking the ball by, you know, whatever that expression is. I was going to say taking the ball by the horns, but that is not the right one. But, you know, just going, Diane, does that sound familiar? I mean, we're kind of getting to the last quarter of our program today. Let's talk about some solutions. Jim is talking about sort of ways that things might get kind of ginned up here more in Massachusetts. What else are you seeing and what else might you suggest?
Well, as has often been said, all politics are local and all change is local, and we make change patient by patient, bedside by bedside, hospital by hospital. So individual clinical leaders gathering data about the experience of patients in their place, running financial analytics on what happens to these outlier patients with very long length of stay and very high ICU costs and very high costs per day, and combining that with real stories about patient and family experiences in your hospital and presenting those data and the stories to both hospital administration and to the physician opinion leaders in your center are very, very powerful. And we have seen over and over and over that those types of presentations have caused big investments in the development of hospital palliative care programs. Because just like doctors and nurses come to work wanting to do a really good job on behalf of their patients, so do the hospital CEOs and COOs and CFOs. They're working in healthcare because they want to do good. They could be on Wall Street if all they were interested in was money. They want to do good. They want to deliver high-quality care, not waste resources, keep the doors open to serve the community, meet payroll. Their goals are really not that different than ours. They just need both the data that makes the case and then a solution. And the solution is a leader or leaders from within that community that says, I want to take the lead. I'm going to make this work. Let's work together to get it to happen. And that's exactly what the person who wrote in was articulating, and we've seen that happen all across the country.
Diane, do you think there needs, several people have commented on this and sort of the definition in terms of Medicare reimbursement for hospice about being able to say that this, if the disease follows its expected course, this person has 6 months or less to live. What changes may be needed there?
If you're a student of history, you know how that those particular regulations were put into the Medicare hospice benefit. There are two eligibility criteria. One is the two doctors have to say the patient is likely to be dead in 6 months if the disease follows its usual course. And the second eligibility criterion is that the patient or surrogate actually has to sign a piece of paper giving up regular Medicare coverage for the terminal illness, for life prolonging or curative treatment for the terminal illness. Now, the reason those provisos were put into the Medicare hospice benefit is because the legislators did not buy the cost avoidance argument that was being made by the advocates at the time. The reason they didn't buy it is because the same cost avoidance arguments had been made in the end-stage renal disease program when that was approved by Medicare, and the cost overruns were very early and very high in the end-stage renal disease program. So in order to prevent cost overruns in hospice and not having everyone and their brother take hospice in addition to life-prolonging and curative care and break the budget, they put these constraints in precisely to control spending. Not because it was a match to the needs of chronically ill patients, because it's not. We don't know who's going to be dead in 6 months. But because it was a way to limit access to the benefit. And, of course, the consequence, as we all know, is that although nationwide, roughly 30% of Americans die with some access to hospice, the majority of those people are in hospice less than 2 weeks, nowhere close to 6 months. And 10% of hospice patients get care for less than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, it really isn't serving the palliative care needs of the chronically ill because it was designed not to be able to serve those needs. It's not because hospice professionals don't want to provide this care. They are prohibited by regulation from providing it. So we need to always be thinking about the unintended consequences of these types of policies.
Yes, absolutely. Tiffany Gaines, Jim and Diane both has kind of chatted in a pretty provocative question. Why does there have to be a palliative care program in a hospital in order for a patient to receive palliative care along with their curative care? In other words, sort of why do we draw a big circle around it and treat it in such almost a kind of rarefied way? Is that part of the problem? It's an interesting question.
Well, I can answer just from the perspective of the conversations that are going on in Massachusetts is we're busily trying to define what the notion is of a palliative care program. What meets that requirements? The needs of a rural or critical access hospital are going to be different than the needs of a very large tertiary care institution. And so what we're trying to understand is what are the core levels of training and capability that we believe need to be in an institution based on the care that it's being delivered. We're looking at work that Diane, National Quality Forum, and others have done in this space. I'd love to hear Diane's response to them.
Diane?
I think the issue is both cross-sectional and longitudinal. Right now, most doctors and nurses have had absolutely no training or appallingly little training in pain and symptom management, in doctor-patient communication about goals of care, in coordinating care in the community. And right now, we have very complex, seriously ill patients who need those services and are not getting them. So right now, we have an immediate need that has to be addressed, which is why there's such a strong press to get these programs available in every hospital. But for the future, I totally agree that we should, if health reform goes the way it should, every patient will have a primary care physician and a patient-centered medical home. And if medical education changes the way it should, no physician will be allowed to graduate from medical school or residency and no nurse from nursing school without demonstrating competencies in all of these core areas of palliative care. At that point, you'll need palliative care specialists for medical and nursing and social work education and for research and for the rare, very complex case that cannot be managed by the primary care team, but we are decades away from a healthcare system where your average physician and nurse has adequate knowledge about how to deliver high-quality palliative care. So we need to have both goals in our heads.
Okay. Sounds like, our hope would be, maybe not just hope, but maybe with some of these changes, while we may be decades away, some of this may also accelerate. I want to remind everybody you can download the chat when you log off today, and there are many, many reasons to do so. Very rich conversation, and we have some wonderful people joining us, including other national experts like Joanne Lynn. Joanne Lynn chatted in some interesting possibilities in some sense, kind of, you know, putting the pedal to the metal, suggestions, don't pay as much for a second hospitalization for the same fatal illness at the same hospital if there's been no advanced care plan. Just beginning to sort of think creatively and proactively, and you've got about 5 points here, Joanne, and I encourage people to, again, take a look at that. We have just a few minutes left, and I think I want to just really thank everyone for being very thoughtful. In many ways, this is a hard one to say, what can you do by next Tuesday, although we still love to do that. So I thought Jim is good. He's got a kind of, you know, pragmatic thing. And I was going to ask you, first of all, do you see things going on in other states similar to Massachusetts right now? And is that where Diane made some reference to healthcare reform and some things that may help this area of advanced illness? What else do you see, maybe more state by state?
Well, the first is I've been struck that there already are a number of states in the United States that are doing extraordinary work, and I think we can certainly see them in the scorecards that Diane and Dartmouth Atlas and others have prepared. We're also seeing states like Massachusetts and Vermont that are now considering this at the legislative level to understand how caring for patients with advanced illness fits into the medical home, the accountable care organization. How does it fit into these new emerging areas of activity? And we're seeing also through National Priorities Partnership of growing community. So I'm excited at the learning that's going on out there, again, very facilitated by CAPC. The Health Resource and Education Trust of the AHA has put together an initiative of best practice centers under an ARC grant that is an absolutely wonderful go-to place, not only for individual hospital, but for community work. And I just want to mention that over the next few months, IHI will be coming out of its research and development group, promising practices in the area of palliative care as much at an institutional and community level as well as a larger level will be coming out. So the exciting news is there's not only a lot of conversation and discussion, but there is now a lot of new information coming out. The first and foremost thing we have to do at any level is we have to declare the current state unacceptable.
Okay.
Until we do that, then nothing else is possible.
Let's kind of just wrap up before I do my little wrap-up remarks. We do tend to, when we're in the U.S., we talk about the good old USA, and we do honestly understand, often politically, we need solutions that people can kind of grasp here. But other countries are grappling with this, maybe don't quite have, some don't all have quite our hang-ups about death and have treated this a little bit more organically. But just here and now, where, if you were, you know, wanted to kind of present, here are some models. Where would you look right now? Diane, can I ask you and then I'll ask Jim?
First of all, I want to say that we tend to think that everyone else does it better than us.
Okay,
and I have to say, having traveled a lot,
right,
we are the only country with a federal benefit that covers hospice.
All right, okay.
And even in the Commonwealth countries, much of hospice and palliative care is philanthropically supported, which is a very frail reed, particularly in the current economy. So, but I will say that the Commonwealth countries, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, New Zealand, Australia, England are moving much more strongly towards a home palliative care model like ours and out of the inpatient sort of St. Christopher's model and back into the home, and also are investing further both in research and in workforce in palliative care, which are two very high priorities for the palliative care field right now.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, this may be a case where the U.S. and many other countries can kind of, you know, lead the way together. Jim?
Madge, I've been struck. I'm sitting on an advisory group where I feel like I'm the student and not at all the teacher for the Guy's Foundation in London. And I've been very struck with some of the frameworks that they have developed. I was also, we're very interested in Massachusetts in the work that's going on in Liverpool and the models that they have been developing. And I saw a post in on about that. So I do think in this larger world community, a global community that IHI lives in, there there is a lot of learning that can come from a lot of different places. I'm learning a lot out of the work going on in NHS.
All right. Thank you, Jim Conway. Thank you, Diane Meyer. You're traveling. I really appreciate that you were able to join us today. And my heartfelt thanks to all our participants. You've got such rich conversation going. There's a photo of us in the studio here, and just a whole other wonderful world going on in the chat here, and Diane Meyer in Chicago. As I alluded to, there's a resource document that's going to get posted with the audio archive of this program today, pretty much by the end of today. Definitely check it out by tomorrow morning. Tell people about it. One of the things we're hoping to do, there may not have been, 1,000 people on today's discussion, but you can forward this conversation along, and we hope you will. Any questions whatsoever, info@ihi.org. Next, actually, in 2 weeks from today, WIHI, that's October 22nd, again, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to take a fresh look at the innovations and new thinking redefining nursing in the 21st century. Information about that is now live on our website, and we encourage you to check that out. Got a really, really interesting group of people, two of whom are heavily involved with a new IOM committee on the future of nursing, including former HHS Secretary Donna Shalala. So please join us for that. The people who make WIHI possible are Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Jane Rossner, and Vicki Minden. The musical selection that opened and closed and will close WIHI original arrangements by Aaron Flanders on guitar and Miguel Sapasoa on piano. Again, big thank you to all of you. I learned a lot today. I hope you did too. And it's really my privilege to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care most of all. For the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, I'm Madge Kaplan. Good day. Tune in again.